Well, it took a year and a half to get this particular interview, and I am really excited because this man is one of the executive producers of a bunch of game shows that you may have seen, and two that are on the air right now, one on GSN, which is Idiot Test, which we'll talk about. But, of course, he is also part of the Summer Fun and Games lineup. As a co-executive producer of the $100,000 Pyramid, it is my honor and my privilege to have to the WLTI airwaves Mr. Aaron Solomon. How you doing, sir?
I'm doing great. I'm ready to hire you as my agent, by the way. So thank you for
having me. Well, that's great. That's awesome. That's terrific. First of all, congratulations on all the success of both Pyramid and Idiot Test. Let's talk about Idiot Test for a second. It just celebrated its 200th episode on GSN. Congratulations on that.
Thank you very much. Yeah, we're really excited. I mean, it's rare in this day and age for any show to have, you know, life beyond six episodes. It seems like that's sort of the new norm. So to be able to have that many episodes, and, you know, I actually was not part of the first season, but I was part of season two and beyond. So, you know, I guess I'm celebrating 160 episodes on the air. So,
well, 150 if you go by thereabouts.
Right? I think the first season was 40 episodes.
So then 160, but at least it, you know, it's all right. A three-quarter celebration. So
there we go.
why do you think Idiot Test has been as much of a success as it is?
You know, it's funny because I've always been of the mindset that, you know, you can dress up a game show with as many sort of bells and whistles as you want, and people falling through floors or getting launched into the stratosphere or, you know, whatever sort of major promotional gimmick you can do. But at the end of the day, I think what will keep people coming back is a game that is fun to play, it's engaging, it's smartly conceived, and it's material driven. And really all of those things, I think, are hallmarks of Idiot Test. And I can say that freely because I was not part of the first season. I was actually a fan of the show, and I remember sort of tuning in hesitantly after the premiere because you just never know when, with a new game show, you're always sort of skeptical. And Craig Brooks, who is the showrunner and executive producer of the show, is a friend of mine. And I called him as soon as I watched the premiere in season one and said, "Craig, this is the best original show that GSN's ever done." I'm not just saying that as a friend. I'm saying that and just I'm in awe of how clever and smartly done and well formatted it was. And lo and behold, there was an opening in season two for co-executive producer. And it was just I was very fortunate to be able to join that franchise.
So of course, as you said, the play along factor is excellent, but of course, you got to also talk about Ben Glebe a little bit.
Yeah, I mean, this is really it is the perfect show for him, and he is the perfect host for that show. And it's not true of everything. I mean, I think Ben Glebe as host of Jeopardy, while entertaining, would probably not be the best fit. But at the same time, this is a show that many people don't appreciate the what we call sort of the Columbo moment, which is somebody locks in an answer and it's incorrect. And then Ben sort of spends 30 seconds kind of teasing around all the different possible answers that it could be. And he has to have such a thorough understanding of every test and every mislead that's there that he needs to be able to, on his feet, come up with a reason why the correct answer is a better answer than whatever a contestant might have picked. And we have no idea what they're going to select. And to be able to have the presence of mind to process all that on his feet and then articulate that clearly to the audience so the viewers understand is a rare talent that he has. And it's, you know, my hat's off to him for being able to do that.
And we're still in the fourth season, correct, right now as we speak?
Yeah, the fourth season's airing. We actually finished production of that last year, so we're still airing the remainder of the 65 episodes we shot.
So hoping, crossing fingers for more, right?
Yeah, we haven't got official word of an order yet. I know there's been a little bit of changeover in the GSN ranks, so I think they're kind of sorting out their executive situation. Then we're hopeful that at some point we'll get a call as they start running out of episodes and need more.
There you go. So let's talk about you for a little bit because you, first of all, you've been involved with a lot of stuff, but we'll get to that you know, in a little bit, because I wanted to just talk about you in general. Were you that kid who bought the home editions of game shows like I was, or was I the only one?
Oh, yeah. Well, actually, I was the kid who my mom bought the game shows for me early on. Because it really, it starts with my mom. And in fact, I'm going to acknowledge her because at some point, I'm sure I'll forward this interview to her and she will kvel is the Jewish term for a mother who's proud of their son. My mom, Anita Solomon, was really the first to get me hooked on game shows. She, we've been a game playing family since I was as young as I can remember. And I used to sort of joke that most kids are brought up on Mr. Rogers and Sesame Street, and I was brought up on Match Game and Family Feud.
Which versions?
Well, the Gene Rayburn, the PM version that was on in the late 70s, early 80s, and then the Richard Dawson version of Feud. There was some version. I just remember being on TV since I was like 3 or 4 years old. My mom was obsessed with, you know, Richard Dawson and as many people were at that time. And we just have been a game playing family. So, you know, from an early age, I just remember saying, I love this game. And, you know, so my mom would take me to Toys R Us and we would find the home game and I would collect it and I would force my friends to play. And I'm sure I would pretend I was the host and do a terrible job at it. But, you know, it was the beginning of a love affair with game shows. And, you know, little did I know that I would end up actually getting a chance to be part of working on these.
But you weren't just a behind the scenes. You appeared on, I think, at least one that I could think of. Or how many did you, how many of you appeared on?
You know, I was actually a contestant on two. I was a Teen Week contestant on Scrabble in with Chuck Woolery in 1988. Mm-hmm. And then years later, I was actually a contestant on Alan Thicke's Pictionary for its one glorious season.
And how did you do on each?
Scrabble actually was very good to me. At the time I was a 4-day champion and I ended up winning $25,000, which at the time paid for a year of my college. So
there you go.
Very happy about that. And Pictionary, I was a 1-day champion. I think I won 10,600 or something like that. Of course, as any game show contestant can tell you, any game show contestant who didn't retire undefeated, who got beaten, you never forget the one you went out on.
Bingo. I will tell you mine if you tell me yours.
Sure. Well, okay. On Scrabble, I will say the one that anybody who's seen my show knows that the one I went out on that kept me from being a 5-day champion, it was Kids Have a Ball at the End of It, and it was T-E-blank-H-E-R. I think as a kid, I never understood that tether is the name of the rope. I knew tetherball. I just never knew that as a 13-year-old, for some reason, that the tether was the term for the rope. So I'm literally going through the alphabet, pushing it. I went all the way from like A through S, and I think I ring in and I say Tesher because I was one letter short of being able to guess it right. So that was the end of my run. And then on Pictionary, you can tell it's still like an open wound for me.
Excuse me, mine hasn't healed in 17 years, and I'll tell you about it in a second.
Oh, I want to hear about that. Yeah. Pictionary was actually, this is one, may he rest in peace, Alan Thicke. To this day, I believe he actually cheated on behalf of my opponent. Because they were struggling trying to answer NYPD Blue. Mm-hmm. And at the time, you were allowed to put, you were allowed to use area codes to represent things. So 212 was sort of the shorthand for getting somebody to say New York. So NYPD Blue was the answer. And they kept saying, New York this, New York undercover, New York cheesecake, blah, 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 blah. And then I remember Alan saying, New York or NY.
Oh, wow.
And I sat there on the couch incredulously. And then, of course, when I went back to watch it, I didn't see it. So someone in the edit room took that out because I'm sure they realized he was perhaps helping the opponent a little bit. So may he rest in peace, but who knows what would have been had he not said that. And I ended up losing by one because of that.
So my wounds of life, shall we say, go like this.
Yes. It's a therapy session.
I'm sorry?
It's a therapy session.
This is a therapy session. Yes. Okay.
Your turn on the couch.
Yes. My turn on the couch goes back twice. First of all, I, as you know, I won $125,000 on Who Wants to Be a Millionaire.
Congrats again.
Thank you. And the $250,000 question was, who was the first woman to be inducted into the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame? And that the answers were Aretha Franklin, Diana Ross, Janis Joplin, and Carole King. And I had two lifelines left, and I missed you, and I blew how I used them. I asked the audience first instead of using the 50-50 first. Mm-hmm. And what happened was is that the 50-50 went Aretha Franklin, Janis Joplin, and the 50-50 was Aretha Franklin, Diana Ross. And I didn't remember if Diana Ross was inducted twice as a member of the Supremes and as a solo artist. And I had Aretha Franklin, but I didn't want to risk $93,000 a guess. So every time I hear the opening chords to Respect, I get a chill down my spine. So on Jeopardy, this was before they had the Unlimited Champions.
Sure.
So I was about to become a 5-day champion and win cash and a Chevy car.
Wow.
So the category – and what happened was that I tied the guy who eventually defeated me on a question on Kemal Ataturk and Gallipoli, which is where the battle where I believe he was defeated. So the final category was health and medicine, and the category was this chronic disease – causes 1 in 6 emergency room visits and 10 million sick days among U.S. elementary school children. Do you know? And I wrote, what is chickenpox? However,
crossed my mind.
However, chickenpox is not chronic. Asthma is. And the fact is, I know people who have asthma. And the funny thing is, the first person who I called was my girlfriend, and she got it. So our good friend, and I think you may know him, Matt Oninger, said, and you just said it earlier, game show contestants never remember the questions they get. They always obsess over the questions they miss. So that love. You got into that, but how did you transfer this love of game shows into the career you have now?
You know, I somewhat fortuitously, because when I was in college, I was not at all.
And where did you go to school?
Oh God, you're gonna date me now.
Not where it is.
Oh, where? I thought you said when.
I said where.
Northwestern University in Chicago. To be more particular. When I was – I had no idea what I wanted to do for a living at the time. I was a math major for a stretch of time and then realized that I just had nowhere near the math capability I would need, and it just was not a passion for me at all. And I sort of decided, because I had a lot of friends that it seems ridiculous at the time, but I was so undecided about what I wanted to do that I started kind of paying attention to the people that I was hanging out with there. And I found that a lot of the people that I was friends with and I found really to be most interesting and having, you know, cool kind of late night conversations with were all in this radio TV film program. And as a kid, it never crossed my mind to be a filmmaker. I mean, I'm not one of these people that, like, you know, from an early age, I knew I wanted to direct or anything.
we all know those people too, you know?
And in a way, like, it's sort of a blessing if you have that sort of passion and you know from an early age, like, I want to be the conductor of the New York Philharmonic or whatever. That wasn't me. So I was kind of a little bit at sea for a while. And I finally discovered that there was a creative writing for the media program at Northwestern, which allowed you to sort of, in the course of 2 years, you wrote a one-act screenplay and a full-length screenplay and a stage play and a TV episode. It was like really intensive. And I thought, wow, writing sounds really cool. I never thought of myself as, you know, like a director or producer. I always thought of myself really more as a creator and a writer. So I ended up applying to become part of the RTVF program and transferring in, and I got in at the end of my sophomore year. So I said, well, what should I do in order to, you know, I realize I'm sort of playing catch up here. Is there anything I can do? Because I lost already sort of a year and a half of eligibility. And they said, well, you can look for an internship somewhere and see if, you know, you can get some credit from that, but also some good experience. And at the time, Game Show Network had just launched, and a mutual friend of mine, David Hammett, was friends with another guy, Daniel Deadman, who had been in correspondence with their head of programming at the time, Bob Bowden. And they arranged for a visit to actually sort of as tourists, as fans, to come for a day and visit Game Show Network. And when I was there, lo and behold, the host of the morning show, Laura Chambers, was my contestant coordinator from Scrabble, like 9 years prior.
Oh, wow. Okay.
And she, this is the credit to her, what an amazing contestant coordinator and producer she is. And she's still doing that. She's still doing talent casting. She immediately recognized me and told me what year I was on and how much money I had made. Like, she just has one of these brains that just, you know, she's so, it's such an amazing gift to be able to do that. So, and it sort of, as I was there, I kind of was looking around. I'm like, gosh, you know, maybe this is a place where I could do my first internship. And so I asked Laura if she would put a good word in for me. And of course she did, which I appreciate. And I ended up getting an internship working with Bob Bowden. And I got experience on their morning show, Club AM, which was a sort of live talk show interstitial format. And then I got moved to their afternoon or evening show, Prime Games, which Peter Tamarkin was hosting. So,
wow. So, boy, did you.
Cross your luck, you know.
Boy,
for me,
did
it was
you.
Totally surreal.
You got to work with you got to work with some incredible people. Did you, by the way? Because I know at Club AM, was that Marianne Curran a little bit?
She hosted GSM Live, I think it was.
Yes.
Later on, which was a later incarnation. It was a similar format, but no, Club AM in the early days was Steve Day and Laura Chambers.
Ah, yes. Okay. Yeah, because I remember those days when you can actually win stuff.
Yeah.
Playing, yeah. And it was amazing. And of course, I was also a big fan of the GSN radio back in the day. So, yeah. Okay.
Yeah. So that was, the really early days. I mean, we're talking about, this is when all they had was you know, libraries of old shows, and it would be, you know, at 9 a.m. they would go on live for maybe 3 to 5 minutes and talk to, if they had a guest in studio, like a Gene Wood or, you know, whomever it was who happened to be available to come in and chat, they would. And then it would be like, okay, great. Now let's watch an old episode of Tic-Tac-Doe. And then you'd see that for the next 20 odd minutes.
Very, 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 very cool. So you eventually do that. And so, What was some of the early shows? Because I have your list up here, but I want you to necessarily talk about it. What were some of the early shows you worked on back early?
Well, in terms of working on, the first show I actually worked on was, there's a lottery game show in Chicago, which I was able to work on because they shot on weekends. So when I was a student at Northwestern, I was able to work Saturday and Sunday for Illinois Instant Riches with Mark Goodman and Linda Coleman.
Oh, wow. There are actually some segments still on the YouTubes out there I've seen.
Yeah. I was a production assistant, and I ended up, by the end of 2 years, I was like an associate producer on the show. And it was a great experience. I get to work at WGN, one of these sort of venerable old TV stations.
Sure.
So, yeah, that was, I think, my first paid gig. And then I came back to L.A. for a summer, and I worked as a production assistant for Family Challenge, the Woody Frazier show, which, now this is the year after Ray Combs had passed. And so Mike had taken over as the host. And it was a very formative experience for me because I have never worked so hard for so little money, but I loved it. I mean, it was like 15-hour days and running around in 100-degree heat and smog conditions of L.A., and I could tell you stories about the horrible, horrible dues I paid there. But, you know, I honestly, I wouldn't trade it for the world because, you know, now when I see we have a production assistant and he's sticking around and asking, you know, do I need to stay late or do I need to do this? I now know what it's like to do that, and I try not to put them through the same paces that I had to.
So looking through your list of many credits, you have actually done a couple of kid shows, mm-hmm. including Brain Surge and yeah. Webheads.
Okay. Yes.
Now, and those are for Nickelodeon. I have to ask you, why do you think there is a vacuum left by Nickelodeon, which is the only place where there are kids game shows? I mean, we're starting to get a casting of a new kids version of Beat the Clock, but why do you think there is still a vacuum of kid shows right now?
You know, it has to do with the executives and the direction that they want to go in. And I can say this because I actually, among my other jobs, I was an assistant for a year and a half at Disney Channel. And the reason I got in at Disney Channel was because at the time, this is for a hot minute, they decided they wanted to get into the game show business too. So they did a game show version of Mad Libs, which produced by Dick Clark Productions. It sort of right. was a one and done. And another show that actually deserved a better fate, I thought, called Off the Wall, mm-hmm. which was sort of a stunt challenge show where you would kids would pick somebody off the wall, which was a pre-recorded video of a kid doing a stunt, and they had to challenge that kid to that stunt, and whoever did it faster got the points, either the pre-recorded kid or the kid live in studio. It's kind of a clever idea. But so despite, you know, whatever the cleverness and the interesting people that were brought in, I was brought in as an assistant because they knew I had a love for game shows. So I was working for the executive who oversaw those. Disney, I remember clearly in a development meeting, they said, you know what? These are doing okay, but Disney is about telling stories, and that's what we do best. And so we've decided we're not going to do any more game shows. We really want to go back to scripted programming. And this is like the way early days before they even broke free with, you know, High School Musical and Hannah Montana. This is like, you know, the famous Jet Jackson and So Weird, if anybody remembers those shows. Those are sort of their initial efforts. So that was one case. And then with Nickelodeon, we did two seasons of Brain Surge, and then there was a third season called Family Brain Surge where they brought in adults, and I actually didn't end up working on it. I was working on another ABC show at the time. And
was that the 101 Ways to Leave a Game Show, that one?
I think it was. I love that you know my resume better than I do.
Well, no, I'm looking at your IMDb. That's why. That's how I'm cheating.
Yeah, that sounds right. But yeah, I mean, when they sort of changed it to Family Brain Surge and then they moved it from Nickelodeon to Nick at Night, we kind of looked at that as, you know, with apologies to anybody who's may still be at Nickelodeon, we kind of think they sabotaged the show intentionally because we had heard rumblings again that they also wanted to get into the storytelling world. And they had, you know, at the time they had iCarly and I'm trying to remember the name of the, Ariana Grande show that she was on, Sam and Cat. Yeah, like these kinds of shows. And they were, even if game shows rated comparably or, you know, were more cost effective for them, they sort of had this image of like, do we want to be known as like, you know, the slime stunt show, or do we want to sort of have a slightly more quote unquote reputable image as creating kids sitcoms and that sort of thing. And they chose the scripted realm, which, you know, is fine, and they certainly have the right to, but I maintain that Brain Surge would probably still be on the air if they had just left us on Nickelodeon because we were doing great ratings in the afternoon.
So do you actually see a future? Do you see a future eventually for somebody else to pick up kids game shows? Do you see a future for that?
Look, everything is cyclical. I think if we've learned anything, people say, oh, game shows are hot or they're not hot, and I've never believed that.
They've always been hot. They've just been... The question is the level of heat between simmer and boil. So
yeah, well, but I think it's all, to me, it's more like what happened, the pattern now in today's sort of quick twitch programming environment is that, you know, somebody comes out with Who Wants to Be a Millionaire, which was a complete game changer. Nobody had ever programmed a primetime game show on network TV in the summer against reruns. That was a new strategy to try to sort of, you know, actually program original programming rather than conceding that it was just rerun time. And then after they did that, of course, every network wanted their big money, $1 million show to try to neutralize that. And then, you know, Greed was a pretty good example of that. 21, which I had the privilege to work on, it was actually my first official writing gig.
Yep.
But I think everyone who works on that would be the first to admit they rushed it to air. They didn't do a pilot, which they should have. And as a result, you kind of watch episodes of that, and it looks like it was really developed on air. They were changing money ladders and stuff midway through, and, you know, it was $1 million show, and suddenly it was $100,000 show. And, you know, it's just, that's not the way to do it. And what happens is then the perception is that you see all these sort of failed successors that haven't been incubated properly, haven't been developed properly. And the perception industry-wide is that, oh, I guess game shows are dying out or they're oversaturated. But my feeling is if you do any kind of a show well, it's going to be well received. And then, you know, networks ought to be open to doing more of that as long as they give it its proper development.
Well, I'm also going to sort of go into a sort of a semi-different direction here. You okay. also worked on a couple of what I would call interactive shows, like mm-hmm. Let's Ask America, The mm-hmm. Million Second Quiz.
Yeah.
Now – I don't think, and you know, we love to interrupt. We don't think that we haven't seen the actual best use of the internet or, you know, online with a game show yet. Do you think so, or where do you think that's leading?
I totally agree with you. No, I think that people have been trying to crack the interactive. Really interactive show in general, but an interactive game, it's a logical place to try to incorporate that. And, you know, it's such an enticing aspect for networks because there's all this ancillary income that can come from apps and, you know, logging onto their website and, you know, other places they can advertise. So there's constantly efforts to try to sync that up. And for a number of reasons, I think they've failed to varying degrees. I mean, I think the thing about Let's Ask America was that it wasn't so much an interactive game as far as viewers were concerned. It was really honestly conceived as a low budget way to avoid having to bring in contestants to a studio. It's like, hey, just
that's true too.
And you know, I mean, that's the truth behind it. But, you know, honestly, for what it was, I actually think the people who brought Let's Ask America onto TV, it was a smart move. It was a very cost effective way to do a show that was not so bad. It really was kind of a nice little show. It didn't set the world on fire, but it had a nice little 3-season run. But in terms of total interactivity, I think that show has yet to be created. I know, again, the knee-jerk reactions that executives have when they see one show fail and they sort of apply that to the entire genre. I think we're still reeling a little bit from the failure of ABC's Rising Star.
Yeah.
And, you know, everybody, they were promoting the heck out of it, and they thought, oh, this is going to be great. America's going to choose who they want to sing in real time. But the problem was you've got time zones, and so they want to go live to the East Coast, but by the time it's on the West Coast, you're watching a rerun. So anybody who's voting, it's not actually impacting the show itself, and there's this sort of sense of artifice and, okay, it's not really the entire country that gets to play along. So, you know, maybe the fact that NBC started to do this Saturday Night Live to both coasts thing, maybe at some point a network will take an initiative to say, hey, let's do a game show live to all coasts that everyone can play. That might be the first real opportunity for people to participate in real time, feel like they're, you know, I just got home and it's 8 p.m. and I logged in and by 8:10 I was winning money. You know, that's what I think people want to feel like.
That, put it this way, whoever cracks that is going to make bank eventually, whenever
believe
that happens.
I'm trying.
Yeah, I know you are. But right now, and this is sort of the main reason why we're here, is because you are part of a very successful reboot of the $100,000 Pyramid on ABC. And we're in the middle of the second season, but I want to go back to how you were approached to be involved with that and the process of that from the beginning, if you can.
Yeah, absolutely. Well, I mean, the true story behind it, and unfortunately it's going to sound inside Hollywood, is that the executive producer, Vin Rubino, and I have the same agent.
Okay.
And so as a result, he was looking for someone as his co-executive producer. And I know they're based on the East Coast, and so they had started to look in the New York area, and to my understanding, there just are not that many game show producers on the East Coast because there's not that many game shows being produced there. So my agent at APA, John Seitzer, really went to bat for me and said, hey, you know, there's this guy on the West Coast who does a lot of game shows, and he's worked on a previous iteration of Pyramid, which I was a writer on the Donny Osmond version back in the early 2000s.
Ah, okay, there you go. I just wanted to make sure of that because while I trust IMDb, I don't trust IMDb, and I didn't want to look like a moron.
I mean, I was lucky that I had a chance to be part of the Pyramid franchise, if you will, beforehand. And, you know, as a result, I learned a lot about kind of how to write the show, how to stack the show, as they call it, which is how you sort of program the different categories and the difficulty levels to, you know, try to create a game that is sufficiently challenging, but not so hard that it's impossible. And so when Vin and I spoke on the phone, you know, he may have had some reluctance to have this guy he's never worked with before that works on the other coast. But we had a really good conversation about the nuances of gameplay. And, you know, I talked to him about the concept of what is a trap word, which is in the main game of Pyramid, you have to think about not a word that sounds interesting, but you have to really, as a writer, think about how you would give clues if this popped up on your screen. And one of the ones I like to point to is birdhouse. At some point, someone put birdhouse in the Donny Osmond version, and I looked at it. I'm like, how are you going to give this clue if you can't say bird and you can't say house? And you know, you have to really stop and think it through and say, okay, this is something a flappy wing thing.
You could say something like if you said birdhouse, you would say it's a living space for a pigeon.
They would say nest, and then you go, oh no, it's got four walls and a roof or whatever, and by that time you've used half your time. So, you know, part of that is just really thinking about, you know, how much success do you really want? And, you know, we always want to give players the opportunity to get 7 out of 7, but we have to look for things like that that are potential trap words. Or another one that people have commented about on the message boards is the word holiday, which sounds like an innocent enough clue. You can say, oh, this is like Christmas Day, or this is the day when you
spell
the word day, which is part of holiday, and you're going to get cuckooed for that. So it's, you really don't kind of have a full appreciation of the nuances of that unless you've been through it and kind of learned through trial and error. So I was fortunate that I had that experience, and I kind of remembered that, and I think that was a big part of why Vin felt confident that he wanted to bring me on board.
So as the details started to emerge, and again, we're going to talk about the community for a second, and then we're going to get to the actual show.
Sure.
When the details started to leak out, and that the show was going to be retro modern, if I could use that sort of term, and it was. The way I would describe it as sort of a love letter to the 80s, the Dick Clark version, and sort of moving forward in a way, people went nuts in a good way because this is what they felt. And was that a conscious decision? Because there were so many different four or five different iterations of it now.
And in fact, I'm going to give credit to the one man who singularly deserves credit for this, and that's Rob Mills, who is an executive at ABC, and he is as big of a game show fan as you or I are. And it's shocking to believe that in the network ranks, where you think about network execs as being these sort of politicos that, you know, are only doing whatever helps their own rating self-interest. But, you know, truly, Rob is a huge fan of game, and I've had a privilege to work with him about four or five different shows. And he loves game shows, and he is a purist, and he, you know, he recognizes that, you know, obviously we're not going to mount, a giant orange cardboard set in this day and age. We have to do certain things to modernize it and make it kind of look like the shiny floor look and lit similarly. But he specifically said, you know, this show is not broken. We don't want to feel, yes, let's do some run-throughs, and, you know, if there are opportunities to enhance things, great. But as far as I'm concerned, he said, we can keep the same theme song, we can keep the same set layout. He goes, I want this to feel like the show that we all grew up on, and it's like a retro experience. And I can't tell you how thrilled I was to hear that, because it's just really rare that you find somebody, you know, with all the pressures that I'm sure were coming from him on top. I mean, he went to the mat on this Sunday Fun and Games, which is now Summer Fun and Games, to, you know, do the orange shag carpet on Match Game and all these other decisions that were made that I'm sure were done at least with his blessing, if not his encouragement. So, you know, a lot of that has to go to Rob, and I'm so grateful that he did that, because I believe that that look and feel is a lot of why people are responding as favorably as they are.
And of course, they've got five, six shows that are doing somewhat well. Gong Show, Match Game, just got nominated for an Emmy for Alec Baldwin. Celebrity Family Feud, Battle of the Network Stars, all that stuff. Tell the truth. Yeah, excuse me. Did not want to slight everybody. But So full disclosure, I did a set visit early in season two. Uh-huh. Tell everyone, you were talking about the authenticity of the set.
Yeah.
Talk about how the set was built to make it look 70s, but it's 21st century.
Okay, yeah. Well, now I need to credit two people for this. First of all, Rich DePiro, who is our fantastic director, he's just an absolute genius and a visionary. Rich deserves a ton of credit for the set design, because he's one of these directors who doesn't just sort of show up and see what the set looks like and then says, okay, where am I going to put cameras? He's involved from the early stages of this, and he, like I do, had a huge passion and a sense of obligation to really create a set that felt familiar, but yet basically had all the technological advancements that we could integrate without making it feel like over the top. And so Rich had so much to do with, for example, the video wall. Like, we have these video tiles that are positioned all around the Winner's Circle pyramid that allow for, you know, when somebody wins, you've got this confetti celebration, and otherwise you've got these sort of sliding pyramids moving back and forth. Rich was the one who went to the mat hard for that. And it's such a great example of a way to add just this life and depth of technology around the framework of that familiar six trilon structure that we all know. Now, the trilons is another huge piece, I believe, of why people are responding so viscerally to this. And that credit goes to Vin Rubino, our executive producer, who, despite the cost, he knew that we could very easily put a single monitor for each of the six subjects. He said no. He goes, to me, what I love about game shows is it feels like you're inside a pinball machine. I don't want to be in a video game, which is very 2D. Pinball machines are, things are moving and they're flipping around, and you feel like you're part of this 3D experience. He said, I absolutely want to have these things spin around, and instead of just having it be a light box, we can mount a monitor on it so that whatever screen is facing forward can have a 3D animation with a sense of life. But when someone gets it right and it spins around, it's actually spinning. So we went out to a place in Long Island, I believe it was, Long Island City. I'm not a native New Yorker, so I don't know my geography. This place called Showman Studios, and they engineered this amazing thing. In fact, I think there's clips that I took from our visit there that are available online of the engineering that went into creating the trilons and the spring loading and how these things flip around. A lot of thought and care went into that, and it was really because Vin went to the mat and insisted that it was worth the cost, and I 100% agree with him.
Yeah, by the way, just a little clue. They're out of New Jersey, not Long Island City.
New Jersey, sorry. Yeah. Okay.
That's okay. Again, not trying apologies to – just want to give them the credit that they deserve for that.
Apologies
particular
to New Jersey. They get enough crap as it is.
Absolutely. So you have the set. You have the game. You need the host.
Yes.
And when everyone heard that it was going to be Michael Strahan, everyone – in the community had a little bit of an eyebrow raised, but he's
myself included.
Right. But he has proven himself to be a very good conduit. Tell us why.
Well, first of all, I had the same reaction. I thought that as soon as they announced him, I'm like, oh, this is yet another example of, you know, it's a game show, but let's not hire an experienced game show host. Let's hire an actor or a comedian, or in this case, an athlete. And I'm thinking to myself, my God, they didn't even hire a quarterback, somebody who's known for being, you know, cerebral. They hired a defensive guy. I'm like, oh God, how's this going to go? But I could not have been more wrong. I could not have been more shockingly surprised by how much of a natural Michael was, but also how much work he put into mastering the nuances of this. And I have to say, this is, try to remember the time at which we were launching this. Michael was going through all that drama with Kelly Ripa on the morning show, and they were having this sort of feud because, you know, Kelly was upset that he was getting opportunities that she wasn't, even though she had been there longer. And, you know, people felt like, well, okay, he's the new kid on the block, and does he really deserve to be getting these guest spots on Good Morning America or hosting the Oscar pre-show, all these sort of things. He was suddenly ABC's golden child, and it was creating all this friction. But in the meantime, he's not only dealing with that drama, he's doing Good Morning America, and then he's doing Kelly Ripa, and then he's doing, you know, Oscar stuff and launching his own clothing line, and he's, you know, not to mention Fox football. So he's got all this stuff going on, and yet he came in 3 days a week to rehearse with us. We had a rehearsal hall where we had a whole tech setup, a mock-up of the set, and he came in the first day. And we had a script ready to go for him. And he said, he goes, you know what? He goes, I'll use the script today, but by next time, he goes, you just tell me if I'm missing anything. And I'll be damned if he didn't just go through the beats and he knew who to go to if the score was tied at the end of four subjects in the main game. He knew about a tiebreaker. He had studied. It turned out, in his spare time, quote unquote, he was going home. He was watching YouTube episodes of Dick Clark hosting Pyramid, and he studied. And he showed up, and he knew it. And it was, I was so impressed. I can't even begin to tell you, with the guy who has so much on his plate. He had brought such a workmanlike attitude toward it, and was so prepared that we gave him so little coaching. It was really unbelievable.
That's a very big surprise, and hopefully maybe next year he'll be on the Emmy nomination list. We hope so.
We submitted this year. This is just a side note, but unfortunately, as it stands currently, there's no quiz and audience participation category in primetime Emmys. So we were allowed to submit for under the category of reality competition, which we did. And Michael was submitted as host as the show was submitted for best show and several other categories. Unfortunately, we didn't get a nomination, but it's sort of understandable because we're up against the Survivors and the Amazing Races and the Big Brothers, who have been doing this for a while and are true reality competitions. So we're hopeful that next year we'll have our own category, and I'm very confident that Michael will get the recognition, at least as a nomination, that he deserves.
So, all right, clear up something for us before I get into the next part of this. Uh-huh. Because everyone who watched the show, and you know the fan base is strong, and you know how the internet gets sometimes, I'm going to just say, why no tiebreaker?
You know what? I will singularly take blame/credit for the current tiebreaker. But here's the reality of it. And I think people speculated about it. And I'll just to tell you, the reality is we don't have the program time that they had back in the 80s. It used to be that there was 24 minutes of program time and 6 minutes of commercial for a half hour show. We now have, I think it's 21 minutes and 30 seconds. So that's 2.5 minutes less. And there's only so much you can sort of trim out of contestant interviews or celebrity interviews. You know, the celebrities come on the show, they want to plug something. You got to kind of do that as in exchange for their appearance. So you have to find some place to trim time and make this a show that doesn't feel like it's edited within an inch of its life. Now, and the Donny Osmond version, their solution to this, quote unquote, was to move from 7 answers in 30 seconds to 6 answers in 20 seconds. And if you remember, that was done entirely to save 2 minutes of program time, because 10 seconds off each subject in each round, that's 60 seconds in each Act 1 and Act 3. And I believe that that is the single biggest reason that that show failed, is because it felt frantic. There was not an experience of being able to have enough time to play along. If somebody gave a bad clue, they couldn't recover and then have that moment of, whoa, you just got in under the wire. It felt anxiety-inducing. And so we were intent on not taking time out of the actual game as we knew it, So the only place, once we got rid of all the unnecessary rules and sort of trusting that everybody knew that, you know, how everything worked, we could not allow a situation where we could have one or maybe two tiebreakers that would extend our show by 2 or 3 minutes. So we ended up coming up with a solution that was based on resolving the tie without having any additional gameplay. To be honest with you, the tiebreaker we used actually came from my experience on Brain Surge with Nickelodeon. We used essentially the same tiebreaker, which was, okay, there's a tie. Well, let's look back on your past performance already. And based on who got their answers in the quickest, that's who ends up winning. So it's not a perfect system, but it was our only way that we could come up with to kind of fairly reward the winner based on their performance without adding an additional gameplay round.
Okay. Second little minor question I have to ask since I have you here. Mm-hmm. Some people think that some of the judging may be a little looser than the 80s or 90s version. Do you want to address that at all?
Well, I want to give a shout out to our judge, who is John Ritchie. Mm-hmm. And he has, I think, maybe the hardest job on the whole show with respect to, all due respect to Michael Strahan. The job of judging Pyramid, and I know this because I actually was the judge on the Donny Osmond version for about a season and a half. You have to have such incredible quick reflexes. You have to listen to everything. You have to be ready to reward a correct answer as soon as you hear it, but also be prepared to buzz an illegal clue and sort of in a split second be able to determine which came first. Did they start to say the right answer right before the buzzer, in which case we give it to them, and if not, we don't. So John, for my money, is the best judge that I could imagine doing this, and I think he is spot on probably 99% of the time with his calls. And you know, the ones that he's off on, sometimes we would talk about, and if we felt that there was an incorrect judgment, as actually happened in the Winner's Circle last year, there was one where it was things you memorize and or things you remember, and it was, they said memories, and he buzzed it because he thought that mem was a key part of the word, and we went back and determined that it wasn't. You know, that's an example of the rare occasion in which John has a misstep, to my view. As far as looseness of judging, was there a specific example that you were trying to?
I'm just saying, like, I've read around that people think that certain things should have been buzzed when it wasn't, and things like that. I wish I had an example in front of me.
I will say that there's a very specific set of judging guidelines that are actually in the rules that we brief contestants on ahead of time, and that they sign and they're well familiar with, and they have a chance to review in terms of if you've given an illegal term or it's a key word or a key part of any word that's mentioned in part of the clue, then we would buzz it. And it's all, of course, at the judge's discretion and instinct. But I know that John takes great pains to be consistent, and what's fair to one is fair to another, especially in the main game when balance of the outcome of the game is concerned. Now, when you get to the winner's circle, John, we've talked about this, and in the event of a really close call in the winner's circle, there's times where John might let something go because we realize that it's only disadvantaging the house. We would never want to disadvantage the opposing player. So if it's a borderline call, and again, I don't have a specific example either, sometimes John will say, you know what, we'll let it go. But, you know, there are certain hard and fast rules and examples of things that I think there was one where it was things in baseball and somebody said the ball, the this, and they very clearly said ball, which was part of the word baseball. Yeah. That's unambiguous and you have to buzz that.
Yeah. Now, what has been the celebrity reaction? Have you been getting, I want to be on this show and all that sort of stuff? Like, what has been that sort of thing? Because you're getting some good game players that have been surprising to some people.
Well, you know, the thing with all game shows, and especially ones that shoot in New York, which is not where most celebrities live, most of them are in L.A., is you sort of have to convince them that not only is it a fun game to play, but it's also like a cool thing to do. Because there was a stretch of time in, you know, maybe the 90s where game shows were treated as sort of the last bastion of a chance to get some screen time for, you know, a marginal celebrity or a celebrity who maybe was a has-been. And so I think there was a little bit of a, you know, like a pallor cast on that. But one of the things that really helped us is Michael being the host. And, you know, Michael, of course, is beloved by everybody. And he has a lot of relationships, including some unusual ones like Snoop Dogg, that we're able to...
who, by the way, now is producing his own show, which is amazing. Doing
Joker's Wild, exactly. But yeah, I mean, we were able to get Snoop in large part because of his relationship with Michael. And when you're doing a first season show and nobody knows if this is going to be a hit yet, but it's also, you know, Pyramid is not a show like Family Feud where you're just one of five people and if you give a wrong answer, okay, it's one strike. If you're not good at this game, you get exposed immediately. So we've had celebrities that turned us down because they said, I don't think I'm good enough to play this game. I'm not going to give names, of course, but you know, anytime someone said that, we would always thank them and honor that because the last thing we want to do is put a celebrity on, no matter how big they are. We would never want to put someone on that was so incapable of playing the game that we felt we were disadvantaging the contestant and ruining their chances at winning the big money.
And but I mean, but again, ironically enough, I think I would give you credit for introducing Snoop to Martha and them getting an Emmy nomination for their VH1 show. You know, you never know.
Yeah, well, I guess they had apparently first met on a Comedy Central roast. And I'm trying to remember who they were roasting, but it was a Comedy Central roast. And oddly enough, they were the ones that when we approached them about being celebrities, they said, well, I'll do it, but only if I can play against Martha Stewart. And Martha said, I only want to play against Snoop. And we said, are you kidding me? This is like, talk about bizarro world. Like at the time, no one really knew that, you know, these are people that have catered to a completely different viewership and come from totally different walks of life. And yet they were willing to play Pyramid. And we said, you know what? Regardless of how bizarre this may be and, you know, who knows how good of a players they are. I mean, we've got a great celebrity coaching team that teaches them, you know, the rules of the game and puts them through the paces and practice rounds and everything. We said, it's worth it. We just the tune in bizarro factor of it was worth the booking. And it was a surprisingly good episode. And by the way, Snoop is a surprisingly good player.
You put it to you this way. I think he's a fan because he's been on a bunch of game shows and been successful on all of them. That's scary. Yeah. You know, yeah. It's truly scary. Now I have to ask you finished season two. Is there somebody that you would want to have as a celebrity guest that you haven't yet?
Oh, there's a whole list of people. I mean, just last night I was watching, Michael Strahan was, on the Tonight Show and Jimmy Fallon was talking about, oh, I'm such a fan, and, you know, we've even done our version on the show, and yet every time we go out to Jimmy, he's not available or not interested or whatever. Now, granted, he's a busy guy, and I don't know what else is behind that, but people like Jimmy Fallon who love games and truly, you can tell that they're just having fun with it, and to them, it's more than just a contractual obligation. These are the kind of people that we want on the show, not just because of their star power, but because you can tell they care about winning and they really want their contestant to do well. And that's something that, you know, we've sort of said in, as we've approached celebrities, because you have to go out to like 600 or 700 different people. I mean, that's what we've done every season. And, you know, just to get the 50 or so that end up on the show, the sort of no rate is, you know, between people being too busy or being out of town or not being game players or whatever reason that they give for not being able to do it. It's so hard to kind of thread the needle and find a celebrity that is willing to do it. But then we have to then gauge based on who's willing to do it. And interesting, you know, is this somebody who we think cares enough about the show and is engaged in it? And we found that the most surprising thing to us with our celebrities is that a celebrity who is, let's say, of medium aptitude as a player, but really wants to win, will almost always beat a celebrity who is really smart, but is sort of above it all and kind of looks like they're sort of only there because of, you know, their own self-interest.
Understood completely. So I want to sort of transition because you're I would say of my age, I'm thinking. In your 40s. So, you know, and all that sort of stuff. And there is a new generation of fans and people who are involved with the show. And I'm going to drop a couple of names. I mean, you look at Adam Neidiff, who has written 7 books about game shows and game show personalities. And you have a younger crowd who still are into game shows. Do you feel that you sort of have a balance of responsibility to the older generation and to the newer fans to sort of get newer fans and things like that?
Absolutely. Well, I mean, I think that there's always a lot of pressure and focus from the network to cater to, or to, I should say, to include a younger demographic, because that just goes to the basic dollars and cents of it all, which is if advertisers can get the 18 to 34 demographic, these are traditionally the viewers who have not yet decided what kind of car they want to drive for the rest of their life, what kind of toothpaste they want to use. So they're a lot more susceptible to, a commercial swaying their opinion. That's the conventional wisdom anyway. But even so, you know, when you go to create a game, you know, we're not trying to create a show that is purely appealing to, I don't know if I can call myself an old fogey yet. I'm getting there. But, you know, it's not strictly about nostalgia. We want a show that really holds up on its own. And if you're just discovering the show on its own, it should work without having any sense of the history of it or saying, oh, I don't really like this, but I get it. They're doing a throwback to the old show. You shouldn't need to watch the old show. It should, everything about the rules and the way it's presented and the pacing and the caliber of gameplay should be appealing to you if it's the first time you've ever heard of the franchise or if you're a lifelong fan.
So speaking of that, because I want to transition into something fun regarding you.
This isn't fun?
No. More fun. This is awesome. This has been a blast, by the way. No. What I mean is your musicality, sir.
Yeah.
And we're talking about your love of television and TV music. Because you're in a music band called The Remotes. How did that come about?
Honestly, it came about from working on several shows and discovering that there's an unusual number of game show fans and employees and writers, creative types, who have music as a sideline interest and passion. And I just kept meeting people over the years. I'm like, oh, this guy, for example, Jonathan Bourne, who is a very successful and talented head writer, now producer, used to be one of the guys who would play piano at Nordstrom, who I sort of held up as, you know, in my youth. I'm like, oh my God, these are like the concert pianists of the sort of commercial wardrobe world. And, you know, I'd meet him, I'd meet another guy who's like, oh yeah, I play a little trumpet, or this guy's like, oh, I do a little singing. And we had this idea about 10 years ago, if not more, of starting a band that did only game show themes. So it started out as even more niche than that. And in fact, we had a different name at the time. We were called the Ceramic Dalmatians.
Ah, yes. Okay. I know of them too, actually.
Yeah. And it was sort of our attempt to kind of that trendy self-deprecation of naming ourselves after the crappiest prize you could win on Wheel of Fortune.
Which I actually have a statue of, believe it or not.
Do you own a Ceramic Dalmatian?
I own a 25th anniversary mini Ceramic Dalmatian.
Oh, that's really cool.
A 1 of 1,000, and it was something I arranged. I actually got it one of the press interviews that I did for Wheel of Fortune back in when they did in New York, and I actually picked that up and I have it. It's a pretty cool piece. I have it on my mantle.
There's a small circle of us in this world that would appreciate that, but I can see myself in that circle.
Yeah.
So the Ceramic Dalmatians actually, we played a couple, we actually ended up playing like an awards show at a game show Congress, which was sort of like a game show version of a Star Trek convention that happened.
I was at one of those, actually, I think so. And I think I was actually at that show, I believe.
Oh, were you?
I think that was like 2003. 2003, 2004.
Yeah, that sounds about right. Yeah, so it was maybe 15 years back. But we, what we quickly discovered is that, you know, the appeal for a band that does nothing but game show themes is fairly limited. You know, we're not going to show up at the Whiskey or the Viper Room and, you know, follow a some indie band and then start playing theme from To Tell the Truth from the 1950s. You know, that just wasn't going to work. So years later, I was just having a conversation with some of these folks, and I said, you know, if we just broadened this out and we did just TV themes in general, and including some of the more recognizable game show themes, but expanding into, you know, some of the great themes from, you know, anything from the Brady Bunch to the Jeffersons, Dallas, you know, all these amazing themes that used to be at the beginning of every show when there was enough program time to actually have an opening theme, we might actually be onto something. And so we ended up kind of fortifying the group. We ended up bringing in a horn section. And somehow or another, through a bizarre set of circumstances, we are now the official house band for the Daytime Emmy Awards.
Now, have you pinched yourself on that one?
Yeah, quite a bit. I mean, there's a lot in my career that I've pinched myself about, because you got to remember, I started out as a full-fledged game show geek. So, you know, and I still am.
Myself included, you know.
Yeah. And I still am one. I mean, I just got really fortunate that I met the right people, and that game shows came up the way they have, and, you know, things have fallen into place the way they have. I really, you know, don't think I don't appreciate that every day.
So, you know, I'm going to ask you just some of the basic game show questions at the end here that we ask pretty much everybody, but I'm going to ask you, something about your latest venture, which is coming out in a couple of months. Through a company called Endless Games. Talk about this is your first game design, right?
I've been sort of I've been pitching game formats mainly for TV for several years now, and kind of gotten close to getting things sold, but haven't quite yet. I decided about a year ago that I was going to diversify my ventures a little bit, and I talked to a game show producer that I've been fortunate enough to work with, Andrew Golder, who was the executive producer of one of the greatest game shows ever, Win Ben Stein's Money.
20th anniversary this week.
Is it really?
Yeah, 20th anniversary. Wow. Whatever happened to that Kimmel guy? I never heard of him.
I think he just left the business. I think he jaded him. Flamed out, as so many do.
Yeah. Yeah. Okay. Well. Win Ben Stein's Money. Excellent show. Really good.
Yeah. Absolutely. And I had lunch with Andrew a while back, and just to sort of check in. And he told me that he had developed a game that he sold to Endless Games called Camera Roll that came out a couple years ago. And I was very intrigued by the fact that here's another way to try to get our creativity out. And I said, huh, you know, that's really interesting, because, you know, with Cards Against Humanity coming out and this sort of surgence in actual what I call brick and mortar game shows that are not even on your app. They're actually things you have to physically play with in person with other people.
You mean human contact? Oh, my God.
Yeah, who would have thought? And it just really intrigued me. And so I sat down and I spent really like the better part of a year developing and testing a game that ended up being called That Was Awkward. And it's a card game that essentially you get rewarded by points for doing various awkward things and saying various awkward things that you draw on the cards. And I ended up, with Andrew's guidance, pitching a version of it to Endless Games. And they bought it from me. They were really intrigued by the idea. We spent about 6 months workshopping it. And they just actually sent me my first sort of production copy about a month ago. It's just so thrilling to hold something in my hand that, you know, I can put it on my coffee table and say, this is mine. I made this. And they're telling me it's going to be available for purchase in late August. Yeah, you can get it on Amazon. It's going to be available in Spencer Gifts and Calendar Club and Francesca's, which is a women's clothing store. And we're hoping to get it in even more chains before this is all done.
How fantastic. I mean, yeah, that's amazing. And now.
Thank you.
So, and again, as a board game player, I will definitely pick that up as well. So,
thank you. Tell your friends.
I definitely will.
I get paid a percentage by every purchase. So that's. That's how it works in that business.
Okay, so just a couple of general questions here.
Sure.
Favorite game show of all time that's not The Pyramid?
Ooh. You know what? I'm going to say one that's I'm going to go off the boards and say Now You See It.
Ooh, Jack Nars, 1970s. Yes. Great show.
Yeah, it was great. In fact, I'll tell you how good the format is I was first exposed to it from the Chuck Henry version that came out. And I, even though that is a far inferior version to the original, the format was so cool. I remember when it came on for a blip of time that I was like, oh, man, a trivia game. And then you got to find it in word search. And I loved how the words would sort of overlap. And what you thought was the start of one word was actually the end of another. I'm a word geek. I mean, that's my first love is word games. So that absolutely spoke to me.
Your favorite game show host of all time?
Oh, man.
You can name more than one. I'm going to name more.
Well, I mean, Bill Cullen, obviously, you got to give credit to for being the most versatile and sort of seemingly effortless MC. You know, obviously Bob Barker, there will never be another master of ceremonies like him, with all due respect to Drew Carey. But then you got Dick Clark, who had, you know, as great as Strahan is at Pyramid and he made it his own, Dick had this sort of, I like to use the word avuncular, attitude about him, which is he would be the master of ceremonies, but he also would kind of make you feel, he would pat you on the back and say, it's okay. If you didn't win, you know, he had that warmth about him, and he was just sort of the consummate, you know, persona to run a show. That, but you know, Richard Dawson was so great at Family Feud. I mean, so many of these hosts are so good at what they do uniquely that it's just hard to pick one.
If there, I know that you know you revived this one, but if there is a format that you could revive right now, what would it be?
Again, I'm going to go way off the board for this one. And I'm going to say there was a show that ABC produced that I actually wrote for called Million Dollar Mind Game.
Oh, and that was so good. That was so good. Yeah,
I remember it sort of like it set the Buzzer blog and online community. I remember everybody was all into that show and somebody named it like the best new show of the year. It was a show that ABC did based on a Russian format that has been on the air for over 30 years.
What was it called? Big Six? I think it was Big Six, Sinister Six.
What, where, when, I think is the, or some combination of interrogatives. I can't remember offhand. Early in the version, there was the pilot we did was called The Six, and then it was Six Minds, and then we turned it into Million Dollar Mind Game because this was when every show had to have either Million or America in the title.
Yeah, right.
So, and we did a six-episode run, and this was Steve McPherson was the head of ABC at the time, and he apparently, like, bought it in the room and loved the show. And the premise of it was essentially you six people who knew each other would sit around this table that felt like it was a high-stakes room in a casino royale. So everybody was dressed to the nines in their tuxedos and evening gowns, and they were shown on a screen what almost amounted to like a one-minute mystery. But it was kind of like a riddle and a one-minute mystery, and it had an answer, and it was something you had to read through. And then you had 60 seconds as a team to discuss it and try to arrive at an answer. And then your team captain would deliver that answer on behalf of the team and you'd live or die by the captain's decision. And it is the hardest show I've ever written for, but it is the most gratifying show I've ever written for because it is an absolutely brilliant game. It is like, it speaks to everything that intrigued me about getting into game in the first place. I mean, the bells and the whistles and the moving set pieces are great and exciting, but I love a game that really makes you think and work and solve something and have a sense of satisfaction when you figured it out. And this show really had all of that. And unfortunately, what happened was it was supposed to air after Dancing with the Stars as part of its sort of elegant evening of attire. And then Steve McPherson ended up leaving ABC, and so the show had not yet been scheduled. So it has this, again, it's tainted as though it's, oh, this is the old guy's game. Let's not put it on the air. And it almost never aired except for the fact that the NBA had a lockout, and there were 3 hours of programming on Sunday afternoons that would have gone to an NBA game that they now had to fill. So they were looking through the archives of things that they already had, and it ended up airing at 2 p.m. in Los Angeles against NFL football. So you can imagine the ratings were not great. People were like, why are all these people dressed to the nines in an afternoon on Sunday? And so, you know, it definitely didn't get its fair shake, but it is such a great game. And there's an episode with the video game geeks that you can see on YouTube. That is the greatest episode I've ever been in the studio to witness in terms of drama and pure excitement and gameplay. I can't say enough about the show. It's great. And I wish that someone would take a chance on it and bring it back, because I think people would find that given its fair shot, that people would really gravitate toward it.
I know that you can't, because you're on the inside, you can never play on a show. But if what show would you like to play on as a contestant?
Pyramid.
Okay, simple.
Yeah, I love it. I mean, it's a word game. It's a communication game. You know, we get to practice a lot. One thing that's kind of fun, actually, is that because I know the show so well and it's sort of in my DNA, I am actually the rehearsal host. So whenever we're getting ready to, you know, do the show and we're testing lights and whatever and getting kind of the whole crew up to speed, I'm the guy who hosts the game. So that's sort of the next best thing for me. But, I mean, I would love to be sitting there and giving the clues and trying to get somebody to the top of the pyramid. I mean, it's such a great end game that, you know, we've done it in the offices, but it would be amazing to be able to do it for real stakes. That would have been a dream, but I guess I settled for the next best consolation prize.
Yeah. Well, let me ask you something. Do you ever see yourself as host material, or do you like being behind the scenes more?
No, I am a realist about it. I like to think that I've gotten compliments actually for my rehearsal hosting, but I mean, that's sort of like being named valedictorian of summer school, to borrow a Dennis Miller line. you know, there's a reason the Michael Strahans and the Dick Clarks and the Alex Trebeks do what they do. It's because they do it. They have a great face for TV, and they have an effortless way about them that, you know, you can sort of coach a little bit, but you really can't teach that instinct. So I have to give credit to those people for having that extra something.
Before I let you just promote anything you want, one final question. What's the future of Pyramid right now as we speak? As we hear about it today, right around 1st of August, what's the future of it right now?
You know, there's been no official word as far as a season 3. I've heard rumblings that, you know, there's been talk anywhere from, you know, we're going to do another season next summer to, I know there's been some discussion about, well, could we syndicate this and make this a 5-day-a-week show, which I personally think would be a great move, because I think there's only so many marquee celebrities you can kind of book and sustain on a primetime level. I think this is a show people would love to watch in a half-hour dose, not necessarily an hour, in the long term, just as they do Wheel and Jeopardy and Family Feud.
All right, Aaron, it's been an absolute pleasure to spend about 90 minutes with you here.
Likewise.
Really, so before we go, is there anything else you definitely want to say to all the fans and to everyone, and just promote where it's on and where the show is on and all that good stuff?
Listen, I think, like I said, you could be my second agent for all the promotion you've done. I applaud you on your research. You know my career better than I do. I feel so privileged to be able to do this thing for a living that I grew up kind of idolizing. I appreciate everybody who posts on message boards. Just so you don't think that the producers don't read all that stuff just because we don't post replies to it. You know, when you have something positive to say, it makes us feel happy that the true fans there's a certain satisfaction we get after producing a show where people that we know are the truest critics and sort of aficionados of Pyramid. If we can please you guys, we feel like we have, you know, hit a home run, even more so than if the ratings pan out. I mean, obviously the ratings will dictate you know, our future employment. But, you know, and even when you have constructive criticism or even calling out legitimate shortcomings, these are all things that we do read, we do take into consideration, mainly because I'm a fan. I had the same criticisms, and for me to assume that I know more or, you know, am in a position to ignore those notes would be foolish on my behalf. So thank you to everybody for being a fan. Thank you for being a critical fan. And I hope we continue to make a show that you guys are happy to watch.
That, and of course, it's on Sunday nights, 10 o'clock,
8 10 p.m.
10 p.m., 9 p.m. Central. Check your local listings and all that good stuff. And again, continued success and congratulations on everything.
Thank you, sir.
Regarding the remotes and the games and all your production success. My name is Jason Block. You've been listening to a WLTI Extra with Aaron Solomon of the $100,000 Pyramid.